And then phone calls. And you said you were going.
We don't have a series, by the way.
No, no, but you know, if I ever get it, it's been one side. But here I was, I didn't need to go on the one side.
That's right.
But even he enjoyed it very much.
So did she.
Yeah.
That was the most amazing speech I've ever heard.
Were you at the lecture or were you at Rose?
That's okay, apparently she's taking.
Yeah.
See, she answered questions as far as. And questions.
At the lecture.
Oh, no, no.
They were excellent questions.
Yeah, she answered questions at the lecture.
I didn't hold the bar.
Which she did a great job of.
Yes, I was trying to bar there. So I don't know where they are.
Well, right now, we don't.
Here's the person I should have called. Colonel, I really enjoy his current story.
It was cool when I was.
He had to meet my husband. I wasn't.
Yeah. But it was good. She was wonderful.
Yeah.
But he said, I know.
She had no choice. People, I'm sorry.
But I'm sure Ellen.
Yeah.
I've been.
She was 96.
Rarely.
She was a shoe.
She was 50%. I don't know.
She's not as old as she's always.
She's a lot of money.
Oh, yeah. Why some. No one that shows great was concerned about the fact that she was. Yeah, I guess I saw it. She has.
No, he's also suing.
That's not a sense.
Well, it was a big stomach. But it could be.
And it was very clearly.
Well, I was hoping on now, no more.
Well, so there'll be another one here. If he doesn't take the interview.
And he had to meet on after that.
Are you on the committee?
No, that's why. She's.
Last one I was on.
But over.
I mean, over well.
Oh, you had.
There are now 14.
What you should say.
I have another.
That's hard.
What's not.
Temple roots.
Yes.
Yeah, I, you know, that's.
Yeah, separate. I mean, there's a lot of choices I have to make.
Yes, exactly. And so.
I did it.
I love the video. The show video.
Oh, really funny, right? Really funny.
Yeah, those videos are good.
Yeah, I wish we could just have the whole series subtitled. Because they're really funny. They're really funny. And it's cute. It's cute too because it's the same actors every time. And then it's also other famous Israeli actors will like duck in, you know, like kind of like Saturday Night Live for us. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Hello, everybody. I feel like maybe the second year, pardon?
I didn't get an email.
Oh, I didn't send an email, Jan sent it. I don't actually have, everyone's email addresses.
I don't think I want Jan.
Since I'm just your faculty, I'm not your administrator. I don't have to nudge you about anything. I just get to come and teach. So today our topic is confrontation with early Islam. So last week we learned about Christianity, and today we're going to learn about Islam, another new religion on the world stage. The goals for today, we're going to start out looking at a map. I'm going to give some historical background, which I would like to use terminology as an anchor. I'm very interested in the role of language and how we use particular terminologies to shape our understandings. So I have kind of an expanded list of terms for everyone that hopefully it will give you something that's relevant both in a historical context, and then obviously my goal is also that we will see resonance into today. And then just as last week we read from the Greek scriptures, I hope today we'll get to read from the Quran, from the Muslim scriptures, which will maybe be a new experience for some people. As always, I like to give you something showing the background from where I'm getting all of this beyond the Melton. And the reality is that I've studied Islamic history and Islam always through a lens of Jewishness, because that's my training as a medievalist. Although my teacher has a PhD in Arabic literature, my direct doctoral advisor. So there's not necessarily one book that I can give you that is a Jewish approach to Islam from a historical, sociocultural perspective. However, I do think it's worthwhile. Karen Armstrong has written about various world religions. Karen Armstrong has written about various world religions for a popular audience, and she has definitely a perspective that, as a Jewish person, you'll notice little things that are coming maybe from a more Christian perspective that may or may not resonate with you, but I do, it's a quick, easy read if you want Karen Armstrong's Islam. As always, Dr. Shenlin gives us a little bit, and then moving forward, as we move into the medieval period, I highly recommend David Bialy edited a series called Cultures of the Jews. It's in multiple volumes. So volume 2 is the one that starts with Jewish life under Islam. Here you can the individual essays are written by different professors and scholars who are specialists in that area. So although each essay is 20 or 40 pages long, it's written by the person who's the exact expert in that thing, which is nice because at once the series gives you a broad view, but then you get a very narrow slice that has more, I don't want to say anecdotes, but more reference to primary texts, so you can really get a sense of what you're talking about. So those are the sources I recommend. Let's start with a map. So where we last left the Jewish people, the Jewish people were living in a newly, let's say, globalized situation where the Roman Empire was dominating the Mediterranean world. Jewish people had entered diaspora, the beginnings of the diaspora in which we find ourselves at this very moment in America today. And Christianity was sort of emerging as a sect among many sects in the Jewish world, and then distinguishing itself into its own ideology and its own religion. So as we look at this map, you can see on the Arabian Peninsula, in green over here, the Arabian Peninsula, geographically, is in between two worlds. It's in between the Mediterranean world of the Roman Empire, and then after the fall of the Roman Empire, what becomes the Byzantine Empire. Again, a Christian-dominated socio-political entity. And the Persian Empire. And essentially, what happens is a number of social and cultural historical factors precipitate a change among the Arab peoples, and Muhammad emerges as a prophet. So I think it's important to see that just as we know Rome spread and all these other empires for these last thousands of years that we've been studying have spread, the spread of Islam, once it's established, happens pretty fast. And as we see, even 1400 years later, some of the areas that are established as Muslim-held political entities persist in that to this very day. So I tried to make the map kind of bigger so that we can have reference to it. And then here are some handouts with, I printed out the slides this way so people could take notes or so you could In modern times, I think we often conflate a number of terms, so I want to make sure that we disentangle them from the outset. So the first term that I have for us is Arab, because I think often today on the news, let's say, not necessarily in these kind of Jewish learning situations, but definitely in the news, Arab, the term Arab, is almost always synonymous with Muslim. But when we talk about the 6th century, or the 7th century in this case, when Islam is founded, so in the 600s, the 7th century when Islam is founded, there were Arabs before there was Islam. And Arabs is basically a sort of ethnogeographic term of the tribes of people who lived on the Arabian Peninsula. They were already Arabic speaking. Arabic was already a language. Semitic language, and it's a little bit controversial to say it this way, but I'll say it this way. There were also Jewish Arabs in the sense of, what is Jewish ethnicity? Now we understand it as a kind of separate thing, but in the Arabian Peninsula, there were tribes and families of Jewish people who lived in similar circumstances as the non-Jewish Arab tribes. And already by the 7th century, by the year 600, there were Christian Arab tribes also. Pre-Islam Arabic culture was polytheistic, but there was one sort of head god of the pantheon. Anybody want to guess what his name was? His name was? Allah. Exactly. And I'm going to speak about Islam in a way where I'm balancing between my respect for Muslim people as a faith group and a faith entity, while also trying to recognize social and cultural historical reality about Muhammad. So it's kind of a delicate dance. Muhammad is born in... So if you flip the page, Muhammad was born in the late 6th century, in around 571, we think. He was a member of a particular tribe called the Quraysh tribe. And to give you a sense of what Muhammad's world was like, he's living on kind of the boundary of a number, the Sinai Peninsula at this time is really this kind of boundary between a bunch of different social and cultural forces. So it's on the edge of what was the Roman Empire, with trade routes, with urbanization, this globalization that we've been talking about, right? And we've been talking about Christianity all of a sudden gave us a monotheism, which is a good idea, right? We've kind of established monotheism is a good idea. Monotheism is somehow connected to human rights. And with Christianity being about thoughts and feelings and beliefs, it's able to spread, it's able to be exported much more easily than something like monotheistic Judaism, which, as we know, has a lot of rules about what you can and can't do and how you can and can't live. So he's living on the border of seeing that kind of urbanization. And he's living on the border of the Persian world, and then also on the border of the Arab world, which is very tribal, which some scholars sort of hint at the fact that Muhammad found tribalism and polytheism to be lacking something. There are other scholars who say that Muhammad also felt bad because Christians and Jews were derisive towards the Arab peoples, of saying, look, we're so advanced, we have monotheism, we live in cities, we live our lives in a particular way. You, your backwater, you know, go worship your many gods. And that Muhammad wasn't happy about this. In any case, he was born in Mecca, and apparently he had a practice during the summer that he would go and sit in a cave and sort of have his spiritual experience. And apparently, or as he tells it, as the Quran relates to us, he receives prophecy. And he receives prophecy in the Arabic language. Very important, the language aspect of it. And he keeps it to himself for a while, but then eventually he reveals to his family and then to sort of broadening concentric circles of the peoples around him that he's received a prophecy about how to be a good person and how to worship the one true God, Allah. That now all of a sudden the other local gods are nothing, and that monotheism has now been revealed to the Arab peoples. That's essentially the start of Islam. So the major year on the Gregorian calendar for what happens next is the year 622, which is when Muhammad takes this message from Mecca to Medina. But on the, this is where things get complicated, on the Muslim calendar, that becomes the year one. So you may or may not know this. So this is a quick calendar lesson.
My friend and I who are Muslim have had this discussion.
Yeah, this is
how bizarre it is that we're both lunar and that everything is so very.
Yeah. So this is where it gets confusing. The Gregorian calendar is a solar calendar, 365 days a year. It's based on the sun, and in astrophysical terms, it's based on the orbit of the Earth around the sun. On the Gregorian calendar, the date is October 30th, 2019. 2019 because the year zero, where we sort of started this count, is supposedly the year that Jesus was born. We say this is the common era, but of course in the Christian world it's Anno Domini, which is Latin for the year of our Lord.
Right.
So so that's one date. The Hebrew calendar is not a solar calendar. It is an adjusted lunar solar calendar. And I know all the way back last year in Rhythms, there was a whole lesson about the calendar, which you can revisit if you need a refresh on the intricacies of the Hebrew calendar. But the Hebrew calendar takes into account both the astrophysical motion of the Earth around the sun, as well as the astrophysical motion of the moon around the Earth. So our calendar, the Hebrew calendar, balances those two things. That is why we will say things like, this year, the Jewish holidays were late. Because we're balancing between a solar calendar but also a lunar calendar, which, you know, from a scientific perspective, as someone who longs for a theory of everything, I think the Hebrew calendar is pretty cool. Okay, so today's date on the Hebrew calendar is Aleph B'Cheshvan, the first of the month of Cheshvan, in the year 5780. Our count supposedly begins with the creation of the world, according to rabbinic understanding. However, in the vast majority of the Jewish world, this number of 5780 is understood to be metaphorical, and scientific reality of the fact that the Earth is being billions of years old is recognized. So we could almost say that it's a sort of rabbinic understanding of when the Earth was created from a traditional perspective, although not meant to be a scientific number. So that's that. Additionally, just so you know, the names of the Hebrew months are not Hebrew. I know. So remember, all the way back, all those months ago, all those weeks ago, when we talked about the Jewish diaspora to Babylonia after the destruction of the first temple, when we were hanging out in Babylonia, we were like, wow, Babylonians are really good at this calendar thing. And ourselves, having been a tribal people and less educated up to that point, we adopted the Babylonian names for the months and brought them back with us. So Mar Cheshvan
So it's the full name of Heshvan is Mar Heshvan, and it's actually Akkadian for the eighth month.
Akkadian? What's that?
Akkadian is the pre-Babylonian language.
A-K-A-C?
A-K-K-A-D-I-A-N.
And Aramaic, where does it fit in this description?
Aramaic is much later. So this Mar Cheshvan or Mar Cheshvan being the name of this month, we're talking several thousand years before the Common Era, and Aramaic does not come into being as a language, as a linguistic entity, until closer to the turn of the BCE to CE. So that's the month on the Hebrew calendar. Also, you may see some of my rabbinic colleagues wearing a shirt that says Rabbi's Heart Cheshvan. That's because there are no Jewish holidays in Cheshvan, and all the rabbis are exhausted. So you can buy one online to your favorite rabbi. I can send you the link. But because the number in Akkadian / Babylonian has the word mar in it, it doesn't mean the same thing as it does in Hebrew, but mar in Hebrew means bitter. So a lot of, in the rabbinic tradition, it was called Mar Cheshvan, bitter Cheshvan, because we had nothing to celebrate. You know, no more three-course meals in someone's driveway sukkah. Okay, so those are those dates. Now, on the Arab calendar, on the Muslim calendar, so again, I want to be very clear, I said Arab. Arab in the sense that this calendar, the terminology and the names of the months emerge out of Arab tribal culture and are in Arabic language, but this is a Muslim religious calendar where we mark the beginning of the count from Muhammad's going to Medina. I almost said Aliyah to Medina because it's like that. From Muhammad's going to Medina on his religious mission to share Islam with the world. So, my years of studying Arabic at Columbia University, proud that even as I enter my fifth decade, that I can still remember how to write in Arabic. This is how you write it in Arabic, the date for today. I looked up today's date for us. So today is the second of the month, Rabia al-Awwal, of the year 1441. So it is today, 1,441 years since Muhammad went to Medina. So the second of the month, Rabi al-Awwal. Rabi means, it's something like spring or flowering. And it's the first Rabi. There's two months called Rabi. There's Rabi al-Awwal, first month of Rabi, and Rabi al-Thani, the second month of Awwal. So we're in the first one. It's like the same way that we have in the Hebrew calendar, Adar Aleph, Adar Bet. And the interesting thing about the Muslim calendar is that it is purely lunar. There is no solar adjustment at all. This is a calendar that's based precisely on the astrophysical experience of the moon going around the Earth. Now, you'll see in your notes that I gave you, the Muslim calendar has 12 months in a year, 12 lunar months. And only 354 to 355 days a year. Now, unlike the Hebrew calendar, where we've now calculated the calendar into infinity, we could tell any date for the next thousands of years, we could tell you what it's going to be. Excuse me, the Muslim calendar to this day relies on the physical experience and observation of the moon. So what that means is you don't exactly know. Some months are going to be 29 and some months are going to be 30, and it has to do with the positioning of the Earth relative to the moon. Sometimes it has to do with weather. I don't want to say that that makes the calendar more precarious, but it makes the calendar less definitive. The other major effect that a lunar non-adjusted calendar has is what?
Holidays change all around year to year, anytime.
Exactly. So the holidays that fall throughout the Muslim calendar in the Islamic year change times. And I think that the impact that this has on people's lives cannot be underestimated. For us, it's annoying when we say, you know, the holidays are late, right? So we have to, you know, it's colder during Sukkot, let's say. But we still ultimately have Sukkot, our fall harvest festival, in the fall. We still have Pesach, which has a lot of spring elements to it, in the spring. We still have Shavuot at a time when the animals are giving birth and there's lots of dairy, so we eat dairy, right? Our holidays are more or less at the same time each year. In the Muslim calendar, that's not the case. So Ramadan, which is a month of daylight hour fasting, can sometimes take place when the days are very short, allowing for an easier fast, and sometimes take place when the days are very long, making it very hard for people to go about their daily lives if they can only eat before dawn and after dusk for an entire month. So, are there any other questions? Any questions about, yeah, Renee, yes. Yeah.
Since Ravi is spring, is that part of where the term Arab Spring came from, the whole thing with Egypt?
That's a great question. It doesn't have anything to do with it. The reason why it's called the Arab Spring is just because those riots and that those demonstrations took place in the spring, and then it spread across the Arab world.
Yeah,
Joan.
My understanding in Christianity that the date of Jesus' birth was tied to Roman holidays. Question, for Muhammad going to Medina, how did that date get selected?
I mean, it was just, I think, when he felt called to do it. I don't know if there was something specific about the date. I think it was more a conglomeration of factors that sort of pressed him.
So we don't know the date. We made it up.
Well, I mean, so this is the other thing. Let me go to, if you turn the page, wait, so Islam, submission to Allah, Muslim is one who submits to Allah. Those are the names, right? If you turn a couple pages, there's a term called hadith. This is a very important concept related to Muslim beliefs and Muslim culture and actually our understanding of Muslim history. The same way that we saw that the Gospels were written after the life of Jesus, the Hadith are oral traditions that are written down mostly after the life of Muhammad. And in some sense, Hadith bridges the gap between what we would call oral history, religious ideas. It's almost like if we had a history book, the Jewish Midrash, the Mishnah, right, the oral law, like the interpretation of the Quran, bringing it into modern times. And a hadith, in a certain sense, is a living conversation that continues all the way to this day. So the events of Muhammad's life we know about from the hadith, which were mostly written down after the time of his life. So was it exactly 622? As best as historians can uncover, yes. But as with all of these things, we're relying on an understanding of writing things down and an understanding of history that may be different from what we understand today. So it can be a little complicated. Yes, Lori.
I may have lost it somewhere.
No, I'm sure. Yeah.
Our rabbis wrote down, right, our, you know, written.
Right, the oral law.
They wrote the oral law, right?
Yes.
So that was rabbinic Judaism. Who wrote this?
Great question. That's a great question. So the hadith is written down by followers of Muhammad and by later scholars of Islam. All different people. It's not categorized exactly the same way where like we have one Mishnah and one or two Gemaras, right? The Babylonian Talmud and the Palestinian Talmud. It's not like that. It's more the amount of material is more copious, and this is where it gets even more complicated. Which hadith have authority is based on which stream of Islam one would find oneself. So, quickly, the Quran is the written down scriptures of the prophecies that Muhammad received in Arabic language. And even at the time, and also to this very day, it is considered the most beautiful, poetic Arabic ever. I mean, it's considered to be the exemplar of of literature. And it is really beautiful. It means recitation. And then the Quran is broken down into surahs. There are 114. And then each of the surahs is broken down into ayat, an ayah, which is a verse, just so you know the terminology. But here's where the hadith gets confusing. Let's turn two more pages. Sunni and Shia.
There you go.
So depending on whether you are a Sunni Muslim or a Shia Muslim is which traditions you give authority to and shapes your understanding of what Islam is and how Muhammad intended Islam to be practiced, lived, etc. Today, the estimate is that about 85% of Muslims in the world are Sunni. Almost all Muslim countries are Sunni all over the world. So we're talking about in Indonesia, right? We're talking about in Africa. The vast majority of the world's Muslims are Sunni. Sunni Muslims believe that after Muhammad died, his father-in-law was the rightful successor to his ideas and was the leader of the Muslim people. Okay? And their name comes from sunnah, which means custom, habit, tradition. If you imagine Tevye, you know, tradition, right? That's them. The Shia, however, are a minority in the Muslim world, but interestingly, the Shia are the Muslim majority in Iran and Iraq. So in terms of our relationship with Sunni and Shia Islam today in the United States is almost always allied with Sunni Islam. Very rarely do we enter in alliances with Shia Islam. In the Shia world, they believe that Muhammad's cousin, who also married one of his daughters, Ali, was his successor. And so either you follow...
Cousin and son-in-law are the same person.
Yeah, it's the same person, this guy Ali.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And basically there are some hadith that follow the tradition of Ali and some that don't. And so the weight of religious or historical authority depends on the stream of Islam in which you find yourself. I was just curious on my own, and I wanted to make sure I had it clear. So in case anybody was curious, the Islamic State today is Sunni, and they are actually explicitly trying to perpetrate genocide against Shia Muslims. So that's interesting. And Al-Qaeda, right? Like Al-Qaeda, was also a militant Sunni Muslim sect. Hezbollah, which is in Lebanon, is Shia. And Hamas in Gaza is Sunni. So just, you know, again, sometimes it's hard to say like, oh, 1400 years ago, you know, even less than that, like as these divisions emerged after Muhammad's death, like what relevance do they have to us today? Well, actually they, in many cases, are saying whether, you know, American countrymen will live or die as they're in service in the Middle East. Yes?
Just very quickly, which of these, I know that it had an issue to do with Muhammad died and who gets to be the leader. Which one comes through the bloodline? Which one goes to the nephew?
The Shia is the nephew.
Yeah.
And Sunni is his father-in-law.
Thank you.
Yeah. Just while we're looking at the terminology, so when we call an imam, like who is an imam, right? Like if we call the imam from the Islamic Center, right? We're doing our interfaith work, we want to be inclusive. Who's an imam? In Sunni Islam, it's probably more like the way we would use the term rabbi. It's someone who is who's the prayer leader, who's the religious leader, who's studied, who knows their stuff, who's going to do the thing, right? But in Shia Islam, it has to be someone who's a descendant from the house of Muhammad. So in Shia Islam, who we would address as imam is very different and is a much more limited population of people. Just interesting to think about, and this is another thing that I think is crucial for us in understanding how Islam functions with regards to the Jewish people, is part of the prophecies and part of what's included in the Quran is something more like our Torah in the sense that it legislates daily life for Muslims. Part of what Muhammad reveals in his prophecies as a corrective to the tribal Arab people of which he himself was a part, is a message of social justice, caring for the widow, right? Caring for the orphan, and a kind of religious ideology that will knit the social fabric of a community together. Now, we've seen that that's a characteristic of monotheism in the Jewish context, and also a characteristic of Islam in this initial Arab context. And the term Sharia, which is the last term on your little list, the term Sharia is almost used the same way we would use the term halakha, as a system of jurisprudence. So, you know, today on the news, if you turn on the news and they're like, oh, so-and-so wants to bring Sharia law to America, it's almost irrelevant because Sharia law is, in America, would be functioning among the Muslim people who decide that it applies to them, the same way that halakha, Jewish law, is only administered among the group of people who've decided it applies to us, right? Or we've decided it applies to us and we don't do it anyway, right? Like that's, I do know some Muslims today, although there are fewer than in the Jewish world or in the Christian world, who are trying to reinterpret Sharia and all of the traditions of Islam to bring it into modernity with a feminist lens, etc. And I'll just give you the name of one scholar. She's a Canadian Muslim, and she's pretty cool. Her name is Irshad Manji. If you want to read more about that. Yes?
Where did Ayatollah come from?
Ayatollah Khomeini?
The title.
So that's interesting because within Islam, there's a notion of political leaders and religious leaders, and the Ayatollah is someone who's invoking both, who's invoking both religious law and a kind of political law. And I think this is always the tension that we're going to find with ideologies like Judaism and Islam, is when the idea of the... Using the term religion almost doesn't make sense in these contexts, but because it has to do with what it means to be a people and what it means to live in society with one another. So another term a few pages back that I gave you is this notion of ummah. Ummah is the notion that the Muslim people are both a political and a religious entity. That what we would call today, you know, religious law is foundational to what it means to be in relationship with other people, and that the two can't be disentangled. So let's read a little bit from the Quran, just because I think, I'm curious, has anyone here read in the Quran before?
Heard it.
I've
heard it read.
You've heard it read. What was it like when you heard it read? I'm just curious.
A child was doing it. I went to an interfaith Ramadan dinner.
Mm-hmm.
This past Ramadan, and a child did the recitation at the beginning.
Wow, cool.
And it was very beautiful. I mean, but I think akin to sitting in a synagogue and listening to Hebrew, because you don't know what you're hearing.
Right.
But the language itself is beautiful to listen to, I think.
Great. Joan, have you heard the Quran read too? No.
Yeah, but it was in Arabic, and I was in Istanbul, and I didn't have a clue what it meant.
Yeah, but what was it like? Like, what did it...
It sounded like, sincerely, we were, I don't recall whether we were in a mosque or whether we were, I forget the name of it right now, a very famous palace in Istanbul, and there was this young man sitting in a booth, mindlessly reading from the Quran in a monotone, not not real slow. We were there 2 hours. I didn't see a sample of water. And I did get to see a sample that they swore had cannabis foot imprint.
Wow.
And I can't remember it. It's Tokaki, is that Tokaki? Is that
Tokaki?
Oh, yeah, maybe it's
Tokaki.
I don't remember. It was a standard word.
Right. So, I mean, Quran means recitation. So hearing that kind of recitation, much as the Hebrew scripture, particularly the Torah, is understood to be something that's read aloud, that is also the Quran is meant to be read aloud as part of its study. Okay, let's start with text 2. We'll read in English. would anyone like to read?
Where are we?
I don't know what page it is.
What page? Thank you,
Katie. Oh, in the Crossroads book.
I
should go through your textbook and write all the pages in mine, because it's really...
She said 81. Did she say 81?
91.
Okay.
The Jews say Ezra is the son of Allah, and the Christians say the Messiah is the son of Allah. That is their statement from their mouths. They imitate the saying of those who disbelieve before them. May Allah destroy them. How are they deluded? They have taken their scholars and monks as lords besides Allah, and also the Messiah, the son of Mary. And they were not commanded except to worship one God. There is no deity except him. Exalted is he above whatever they associate with him.
Okay. What's the text saying? Anybody?
There's only one God.
There's only one God. Okay.
And it's Allah.
And everybody else is impossible.
Tell me something specific about the Jews and something specific about the Christians.
Well, they're saying that the Christians are worshiping somebody in addition to God.
Okay.
They were not commanded to do so.
Okay. And what about us? What about the Jewish people? So first of all, has anybody ever heard this anywhere in Jewish scripture that Ezra is the son of God?
No.
Now, when did we last see Ezra in this course particularly?
When we were talking about the lineage and the family.
And Ezra brought the Torah back and was reading the Torah out loud to the Jewish people. That was where last we saw Ezra in this course. There was nothing about him being divine. He was a political figure, but he was certainly not understood to be divine.
So
yes.
Where did the Muslims get this?
That's a great question. and that's what's sort of interesting of reading the Quran and reading it from a sociocultural historical perspective and trying to untangle where do Muslim ideas about Jews and Christians emerge and how are they transmitted? Because essentially from a Jewish perspective, we would say, this doesn't make any sense. Jews don't think Ezra was the son of God.
God doesn't have kids.
Well, right. I mean, that's not our thing. I think Christians might quibble less with the idea that the Messiah, and here they mean Jesus, the Quran is speaking of Jesus specifically, is the son of Allah. But then, what is the last statement in that little paragraph there?
Destroy them.
How are they deluded? How are they deluded? The idea, I think, Danielle, you said it, that somehow Allah, as the monotheistic God of all, having been revealed in these prophecies to Muhammad, if you are also worshiping Jesus, or let's say the Holy Spirit, or offering prayers to Mary, you're not a monotheist anymore. And in the Jewish case, he's saying that the Jews are worshiping Ezra in some way, which, you know, whether the Jews in the 7th century, the Jewish tribes who were living in the Arabian Peninsula were worshiping Ezra, I don't think it's probably the case. But they're also saying it's not going to be acceptable in a Muslim context. Is this surprising to anybody? Has anybody seen this before? No? Yeah.
Well, I think what's interesting to me is that
at least from the limited knowledge that have the it's very introspective. And this seems immediately to be about others and comparison.
That's great. Yeah. Whereas we might look at the Mishnah, and the Mishnah, which is a more contemporaneous Jewish, I don't want to say holy, but jurisprudential document from the same period, also is maybe a bit more exterior. So, yeah.
I also wonder how, let us say that Ezra was held in high esteem as a prophet, you know, at that time. How is that different from the way they viewed Muhammad? And why is that any less monotheistic than saying that Muhammad was a prophet?
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, Renee.
There's also, it says, may Allah destroy them. I have heard, and I don't know if it's true, that in one place in the Quran that we as a people other than Muslims need to be destroyed. And then there is another place in the Quran that says the opposite.
So this is again the same way that we would say, if you read in the Torah, God forbid, that it says all gay people, you know, that gay men have to be stoned and destroyed. Well, we don't necessarily understand it like that. So again, I think this is a matter of interpretation and of the received traditions, right? Like, I think, and that's, I mean, Irshad Manji, this particular contemporaneous to now scholars, talking about how do we understand these ancient ideas that maybe had to do with a particular societal issue that was happening at the time that Muhammad lived with the Jewish tribes, right? And there's a hadith in your reader, that's text one, a tradition that talks about some wars within Arab tribes having to do with Islam and Muhammad sharing his prophecy, and that the Jewish tribe were sort of caught in the middle, let's say, which is going to be a continued theme as we move through the medieval period and the Jewish people living under Islam. Yes?
There are contradictions in Quran that are similar to the contradictions in Torah. We talk about when the Israelites crossed into the Promised Land, weren't they instructed to kill everything in the cities they conquered? And then other places tell us to be careful with the widow and don't put a stumbling block. Quran has sword verses to go out and conquer the world. And then they too have paragraphs saying, be nice to people and help the widow and help the
children. Exactly.
So the parallels are striking.
Exactly. Let's read one last text from the Quran, and then I want to read something from a political document that ends up setting the stage for how Jewish life under Islam unfolds for the next 1,000 years, more or less. So let's read text four. If someone else could read. Oh, thank you, Mimi.
Oh, you who help me lead, do not take the Jews and Christians as allies. They are in fact allies of one another. And whoever is an ally to them among you, then indeed he is one of them. Indeed, Allah guides not the wrongdoing people.
Yeah.
It seems to be an effort throughout the work to one, respect the traditions of the Jews and Christians, and two, to say that Jews and Christians have deserted their monotheistic tradition, and Muhammad defends their monotheism and condemns their straying away from the truth.
Beautiful. That's a perfect, I didn't even pay you to say that, but that's the perfect transition to what happens. So one of the terms that I wanted to make sure that we got to, because it's going to end up being very relevant as we move into the medieval period, in the packet I gave you, is this term dhimmi, which you may have heard, because it's even a term that's used today. So in Sharia law, dhimmi literally means protected one. And what it ends up meaning is that within Sharia law, people who are monotheistic, however gone astray they may be, in their monotheism. But Jews, Christians, and in some cases Zoroastrians, have a particular political status under Sharia law where they do not have to be destroyed, where they do not have to be forcibly converted, where they may exist as their own monotheistic community with some restrictions on their lives and as long as they pay a tax. So you can see why in some cases, if we look back at the map, as Islam spreads, and if you think about at this point in Jewish history, almost all of the world's Jews were living under Islam by the year 900. They're not, the Jews are not in Ashkenaz, the Jews are not in Europe yet, the Jews have not gone farther along the Silk Road. Like, basically, you know, there are probably, there are most certainly some Jews in what is today Italy and elsewhere in the Byzantine Empire, but something like, I don't know, 85-90% of the world's Jews are living under Islam at this time. So you can see how having a particular political class for Jews could be a good thing. Also a protected political class for Christians could be a good thing. If you're coming to expand, you've got an urbanized Jewish community living in, you know, a former Roman settlement in Hispania, let's say. Let them be, just tax them. That will help fund the Muslim expansion. So this is, again, another kind of globalization, an urbanization, where the Arab people are going to expand throughout the Mediterranean world. So let's read from this. Let's read from text 7. So this is from the Pact of Umar. This is a foundational kind of jurisprudential text that helps to legislate the existence of dhimmi under Muslim rule. So this is already, this comes to take place, I'm looking for the exact date in my notes because I don't think it gives it in yours. I think this is already in the 9th century at this point. So let's read, because I think this is very instructive for what it was going to be like for Christians and Jews living under Islam. Does anybody want to? I know the names are like hard, but sorry, it's text 7.
95.
Yeah.
95.
Thank you. Oh, thanks, Mimi. You're so cute.
I can't bear to see if she can just the Pact of Umar, whatever that name is.
Abd al-Rahman, so that's the name of a, it literally means servant of the
merciful.
The merciful one, right? The servant of the guy with Rahmanis, to translate it into Yiddish. It's the same word, Rahman. It's the same word as Rahmanut in Hebrew. Yep. So he's, yeah.
Born Ganaman, related the following. When that guy, may Allah be pleased with him, made peace with the Christian inhabitants of Syria, we wrote him the following. In the name of Allah, the merciful, the beneficent, this letter is addressed to Allah's servant, Umar, the commander of the faithful, by the Christians of such and such city. When you advanced against us, we asked you for a guarantee of protection for our persons, our offspring, our property, and the people of our sect, and we have taken upon ourselves the following obligations toward you, namely, we shall not build in our cities or in their vicinity any new monasteries, churches, hermitage, or monk cells. We shall not restore by day or night any of them that have fallen into ruin or which are located in the Muslims' quarters. We shall keep our gates wide open for passers-by and travelers. We shall provide 3 days' food and lodging to any Muslims who pass our way. We shall not shelter any spy in our churches or in our homes, nor shall we hide him from the Muslims. We shall not teach our children the Quran. We shall not hold public religious ceremonies. We shall not seek to proselytize anyone. We shall not prevent any of our kin from embracing Islam if they so desire.
Maybe does someone else want to take a turn to read?
We shall show deference to the Muslims and shall rise from our seats when they wish to sit down. We shall not attempt to resemble the Muslims in any way with regard to their dress, for example, with the conical cap, the turban, sandals, or parting the hair in the Arab fashion. We shall not speak as they do, nor shall we adopt their Arabic surnames. We shall not ride on saddles. We shall not wear swords or bear weapons of any kind or ever carry them with us. We shall not engrave our signets in Arabic. We shall not sell wines. We shall clip the forelocks of our head. We shall always adorn ourselves in our traditional fashion. We shall bind the type of belt around our waists. We shall not display our crosses or our books anywhere in the Muslims' thoroughfares or in their marketplaces. We shall only beat our clappers in our churches very quietly. We shall not raise our voices when reciting the service in our churches, nor when in the presence of Muslims. Neither shall we raise our voices in our funeral processions. We shall not display lights in any of the Muslim thoroughfares or in our marketplaces. We shall not come near them with our funeral processions. We shall not take any of the slaves that have been allotted to the Muslims. We shall not build our homes higher than theirs. When I brought the letter to Umar, may Allah be blessed, pleased with him, he added the clause, we shall not strike any Muslim. We accept these conditions for ourselves and for the members of our sect, in return for which we are to be given a guarantee of security. Should we violate in any way these conditions which we have accepted and for which we stand security, then there shall be no covenant of protection for us, and we shall be liable to the penalties for rebelliousness and sedition. Then Umar, may Allah be pleased with him, wrote, sign what they have requested, but add two clauses that will also be binding upon them. Namely, they shall not buy anyone who has been taken prisoner by the Muslims, and that anyone who deliberately strikes a Muslim will forfeit the protection of this pact.
So the Jews and the Christians are under a category within Islam called al-kitab, which means the people of the book. Am ha-sefer. I mean, we call ourselves that in Hebrew, so it's not strange that that would be a category for us, being that Jews and Christians have a divine revealed scripture, each in their own language. And although, if you look at this map and think about all the different Jewish and Christian settlements that must have been a part of the Muslim expansion, we do not have records of what happened in those places as Islam swept through. The Pact of Umar does give us an example of what local treaties might have been like. And we see in later documents, going up into the medieval period of Jews under Islam, that these are exactly the kind of, strictures that are accepted by both parties to allow people to continue to persist in their own faith. The interesting thing is that Islam is a proselytizing religion, as is Christianity. Judaism at this point is not proselytizing. The Jews are not interested in going out and trying to get other people to become Jewish. So looking at the Pact of Umar as a particular text negotiating the relationship between Christianity and Islam, there are some things that were probably very difficult for the Christians of this time to agree to not publicly put a cross, outside their church. Some of these things would have been very difficult. For the Jewish community, it was less of an issue. And what we do see in later periods is that in places where where Muslims and Christians were fighting for political sovereignty, the Jews would always be kind of straddling that line back and forth of who they're gonna make the treaty with based on who's better for the Jews, right? Who's good for the Jews, where's good for the Jews. So I think some interesting things about social and cultural history stand out. Dress, that dress is meant to be distinguishable between people of different faiths. So just visually, when we think about today issues around assimilation, it's very interesting to imagine where you could just know someone's religion based on looking at them, what community they were a part of. And you could see why they would want that and why they would want to enforce that. But why do we make rules about things? Because it's probably already being broken. So again, using Arabic language, as Muslims sweep through the Mediterranean and Arabic language spreads, Christian and Jewish dialects of Arabic emerge in various locales, and that ends up being both good and problematic from a Muslim perspective. Notice, you shall not teach your children the Quran. If your family wants to learn Quran, you're going to come and do it in a Muslim context. You're not going to teach a perverted version of our scripture. Very interesting, right? About who controls knowledge and who controls authority. We're already over time, so more to come. Sorry, I just looked at my watch. So anyways, next week, I think we're going to learn about the Geonim, the geniuses. Gaon literally means genius. We're going to learn about the Rabbinic Academy and talk more about rabbinic authority in this context.
Danielle?
Yes. Yeah.
What was the volume on that book on the cultures?
This was the second volume.
That's the second.
Okay. That's where we're moving to now. But yeah. If you want to recap everything. I don't know if they published it all in one heavy book or if it's only in a smaller volume. Yeah.
For me.
Are you going to see your grandchildren?
Because
you're a second class,
you
can't write a whole salad. Right? You can't build your second class taller than the mosque. Yeah.
I don't know how it's become.